Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. With me in the studio today is In Context military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon.
My fellow host, Gus Canavero, is away. As we begin the show, let's remember the victims of last week's tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Our thoughts and prayers go out to their families in this incredibly difficult time. With the approach of Christmas, our thoughts turn to the important role of religion in the lives of so many people. In our Christmas Eve show, Gus and I are going to discuss how people celebrate Christmas and how they express their Christian values. And our guests will be representatives of two of our important local charities, the Thomas Merton Center in Bridgeport and the New Haven Community Soup Kitchen. That will be on In Context next week, Christmas Eve at noon. In today's show, we're going to discuss another religion that's very important in America and around the world, Islam. And joining us in the studio in just a few minutes to help us learn about Islam will be Dr. Kareem Adib, an Islamic scholar based in Fairfield, Connecticut. Before we get to our guest, Dr. Adib, let's just review some very important headlines that the listener should know about. In particular, Marchand, as military affairs commentator, what's your assessment of Washington's decision to provide six Patriot missile batteries, which are going to Turkey to be positioned on the border with Syria?
Well, what I think is amazing is the fact that none of this has had to pass a referendum or a vote through Congress. The notion that simply because we've decided to act through NATO, we don't need a declaration of war in order to deploy these Patriot missiles, because in essence, that's what it is. We are deploying Patriot missiles to the border with Syria, in Iran, to the border with Syria, in order to protect nominally the Turks from the Syrians, Turkey being a NATO member, but also in order to enforce a no-fly zone. Patriot missiles, in case folks out there are wondering, is a surface-to-air missile system. It's a rather antiquated system. It dates back to the 90s, early 90s.
It's the best we have at the moment?
Exactly. Well, because we haven't had to fight an enemy with an actual air force in with a substantial air force in quite a while, so we haven't had the need to really upgrade our Patriot systems. But its main job is to intercept aircraft and Scud surface-to-surface missiles, and which we believe these Soviet-era Scud surface-to-surface missiles are loaded with chemical weapons that may be used against the Turks. So we're deploying these missile batteries nominally to protect the Turks, but again, they can be used to enforce a no-fly zone over Syria. These 400 American soldiers are going to be, for all intents and purposes, in harm's way.
There are 400 soldiers going with the missile batteries.
Exactly. We're not just simply giving them missile batteries. We're giving them 400 U.S. soldiers.
So this is a significant escalation in our efforts to overthrow the Syrian government?
Absolutely. In fact, the Iranians, who recently declared that they will not allow Assad to fall, said that this was one step towards igniting a world war. And to that end, Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, president, I always get confused with his prime minister or president, he and Medvedev switch all the time, but President Vladimir Putin said that if you leave a gun hanging on a wall at the beginning of a play, by the end of the play, it will be fired. And that's a quote from Chekhov, the famous Russian playwright. So, to the Russians, this represents a massive escalation. To the Iranians, this represents a massive escalation. And right now, the Russians have the Black Sea Fleet stationed in the Syrian port of Tartus, according to U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence, unloading arms and special forces for Assad.
Now, this war is not at all what people think it is if they're getting their information from network television or other major media. We're the only station, I believe, that's been reporting what's really been going on there. And we've been doing this for over a year now, relying largely on foreign sources. And the real deal is that Syria was targeted. way back in 2001 as one of eight countries that we were going to overthrow. And it's really the last domino to fall before Iran. And what's been characterized in our press over and over again as a spontaneous democratic uprising has in fact been orchestrated by NATO and the United States, that the soldiers, the so-called rebels, are composed largely of terrorists brought into Syria by U.S. allies, Qatar in particular. And this has been reported in Israeli sources, in particular in DEPCA, military intelligence newsletter that we often cite on the phone. And even the New York Times has acknowledged that we have operatives along the Syrian-Turkish border who are directing the training and the arming of the supposed democratic resistance fighters. So the real deal is, folks, this is another effort to overthrow yet another country. And this time the game is a little different because Libya, the last country we overthrew, had no friends. Syria has some important friends, particularly, Marshawn, talk about their friendship with Russia.
Well, Assad has been a close ally of the Russians, most notably because he offers Russia their only port on the Mediterranean. Now, this is something, if we want to take this in a historical context, something the Russians have been fighting for decades. They actually, if we want to go back all the way to the Crimean War of the 1850s, that was the reason for the Crimean War, and that was the reason for the Russo-Turkish War of the same period, was because the Russians wanted to control the Dardanelles Strait. They wanted to control access to the Mediterranean. Now, the Syrian port of Tartus gives the Russian Navy access to the Mediterranean. And so that's why the Assad regime can last, that's why the Russians have such a vested interest in it.
So how about the role of the Iranians then?
Well, the Iranians similarly want to back the Syrians, because again, it's an anti-U.S. force. Their hope is to push U.S. influence out of the Middle East and stop U.S. military hegemony over the region.
And another important incident that occurred just recently, we're gonna have to watch to see what's the deadline. The Patriot missile batteries are supposed to be up and running at the end of January. Are you looking for this war to significantly escalate by the end of January or February?
Absolutely, I would say by the end of January or February, we'd be likely to see a significant escalation in the war with Syria, especially because the Iranians and the Russians have pledged to keep Assad in power. With these Patriot missile batteries, we're going to be in a position to take out the Syrian Air Force, to give air cover, in essence, to the Syrian rebels without actually having to deploy our own air force and thus risk losing American pilots.
So folks, watch for the propaganda campaign to increase over the next few weeks that we've got to go in and protect all these poor people. And what's going on in Syria is terrible, but we have a heavy hand in creating this violence, and you're going to be subjected to a propaganda campaign like we heard with Libya, that supposed humanitarian intervention, which is reduced to a once stable and prosperous country. Admittedly, it was run by a dictator, a guy nobody liked, but it is now complete anarchy. It's run by armed militias.
And they're
committing genocide. They're killing the black Libyans are being wiped out. It's not being reported in our press anymore.
I gotta admit, I do find it a little comical that we say, well, you know, we liberated Libya, we gotta liberate Syria, and it's kind of like, I don't think anybody really wants to be liberated the way Libya was liberated.
Go back to a man we've cited, George Kennan, many years ago, right after World War II. Chief architect of Americans' foreign policy after World War II, he's got quotes, and I'll paraphrase him, that with the war ending, World War II ending, the United States controls a disproportionate share of the world's wealth. The objective of our foreign policy, he said, must be to maintain this share of our wealth. And he said, in this future foreign policy, there is no room for altruism.
Well, and similarly, Vladimir Putin, in his own manifesto, said that he who controls the world's supply of natural resources controls the world.
So folks,
they're all on the same
They're going to keep feeding you a line of you know what, but it's all about the oil and other precious resources. But we'll have to leave that. We'll watch that next week and the following week. Of course, we have our war report, monthly war report, at the end of the on the last Monday of the month. But we're very pleased to be joined in the studio today by Dr. Karim Adib. He's an Islamic scholar. He's based in Fairfield, and we're going to talk about the important role that Islam plays in the world today. And though he isn't a Muslim, Dr. Adib received his education through high school at a Catholic school in Tripoli in his native Lebanon. Fluent in six languages, he holds a PhD in engineering, and he's a professional engineer consulting in areas including structural, forensic, and geotechnical engineering. Dr. Adib is also the founder, president, and imam of the American Institute for Islamic Studies. Over the last 22 years, he's lectured on Islam and religious tolerance in Fairfield and Westchester counties. And since 2009, Dr. Adib has been delivering monthly sermons at the United Nations in New York City. So, Dr. Adib, many thanks for joining us on In Context today in the studio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Adib, for our audience who are know very little about Islam, could you briefly describe the basic tenets of Islam?
The basic tenets of Islam is stated in the Christian prayer when he said, Our Father, thou art in heaven. There is a sentence that said, Thy will be done on earth as in heaven. When you believe that thy will be done on earth as in heaven, then you submit to the will of God. And Islam is, in essence, a total submission to the will of God.
So there isn't an elaborate doctrine about the nature of God or that you have to subscribe to?
Yes, the nature of God is beyond our understanding. We call it alam al-ghayb in Arabic, which is the word of that you can neither dream of or conceive or even remember or just think about. He is not like any other being. God is absolute. God is infinite. God is beyond any vision. God has 99 attributes of perfection, beginning with being the merciful, ending by being the patient. And he has a lot of attributes. He's the creator. And Islam is an Abrahamic religion, actually, Abrahamic religion.
Well, talk about the origin with Muhammad.
Well, the origin was Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he was born an orphan. His father died before he was born. And then after he was born, when he was 4 years old, his mother died. And so he was taken from one home to another. In present-day standards, he had been a delinquent. He turned out to be a very faithful person and a very trustworthy person. In fact, they call him the trustworthy. He used to go to a cave in the mountain and kind of meditate. I mean, what am I doing here? Why am I in this earth? He was very, very, and he was illiterate, by the way. He could not read nor write. In one of these, and he married a woman who was older than he is, because she used to have a caravan that goes to Syria and back from the Arabian Peninsula. And what happened that she got him to manage one of her caravans, and when he came back, she found out he made her more money than anybody else. So she thought he was trustworthy, and she proposed to him. She sent him, and he wanted to marry him. And he was younger than she was, and he married her. She was a very dignified lady, very wealthy, and he was to go up to the mountain and meditate. One of these days, you know, Gabriel appeared to him and squeezed him, and the guy was frightened. He said, "Read." And the prophet said, "I can't read." Squeezed him, he said, "Read." He said, "I can't read." The third time, he said, "Read in the name of the Lord who created." And then he ran down the mountain. He was all perspiring, sweating. I came to his wife, and he told her, "Listen, I think I was controlled by the jinns, the devil, Satan, whatever it is. It doesn't make." I said, "What happened?" She said, "This happened to me." She said, "It cannot be the evil power, because you are kind, you are trustworthy, you are kind to the kids, to the elderly. Let's go to my cousin." Her cousin was Waraka ben Naufal, who was a scholar of Christianity. He was a monk. He told him, and he looked at him, and he said, "You are the one mentioned in the Bible." And I searched in the Bible, and in Deuteronomy, chapter 19, verse 19, see, I studied catechism.
Yes.
God spoke to Moses and said, "And shall raise them a prophet like unto thee, a prophet from their brethren like unto thee, I shall put my word in his mouth, and I shall command him. Now, who are the brethren of the Jews? The Arabs, because they come from Ishmael and Isaac. And like unto thee, which means like Moses. Moses didn't have a father. He didn't live with his mother. Muhammad, the same thing. Moses led his people. Muhammad led his people. And he said, I shall put my words in his mouth. We believe the Quran is the revelation from God. And I shall command him. And the first order to Prophet Muhammad by angel gave was read, which is an imperative. So Waraka bin Nawfal said, you are the person who is mentioned in the Bible. I wish I will be there when your people will kick you out of your city. He said, will they kick me out? He said, indeed they will. And this is how his message started.
Now this took place in what, the 7th?
About 640.
Okay, so about six centuries after Jesus.
Yes.
Okay, and how would you compare then the religion that evolved from Muhammad with Christianity? What are the similarities and the differences?
With Christianity, you see, Christianity was the word of Jesus were documented and recorded later on. St. Paul, what we know from Christianity is actually more from St. Paul and Peter and the disciples. In the case of Prophet Muhammad, the companions are compiling his sayings and his revelations. So it was documented. It is the same, actually, let me backtrack and say, you know, I don't believe there is three religions. There are three religions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I think there is one religion with three traditions.
Yes.
Every religion has a twofold message. One is to inform, and the other one to legislate. As far as information, it's the same. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, there is one God. There is accountability, the story of creation, hell.
And historically, fire. They all come from Abraham.
They all come from Abraham. He's the paternal, you know.
The patriarch, yeah.
Patriarch of all. And in fact, when we pray, every time we mention Prophet Muhammad, we mention Abraham at the same time.
So the idea is that Muhammad is a prophet in the tradition of the prophet, great prophets of the Hebrew scripture, but he's the last prophet, right?
He is the last prophet according to our creed.
I see.
He is the seal of the prophets. And it makes sense because God sent to the Abrahamic people, he sent Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. If you don't follow those three strikes, and you're out.
So how do Muslims regard Jesus?
There we go. We regard Jesus as a great person, as a great prophet, as a human, but not as the Son of God. And we don't believe that we are created to the image of God because God has no image. So we believe that in us there is the Spirit of God. There is this saying from the prophet that when the fetus is in his mother's womb, between 90 days and 120 days, the Spirit of God is blown into him, and this is where he has life. Then he becomes a human being. And when we die, our soul leaves, and it returns to God. It's part of God. So in a Judeo-Christian concept, we are created to the image of God, which means there is something divine in our appearance. In Islam, we have within us the Spirit of God.
Yes.
So in all three traditions, we have something divine in us. And no religion teaches you to demonize any other human being because you're demonizing deity in them.
How would they feel about the crucifixion and the resurrection?
It's mentioned in the Quran that the crucifixion occurred. It was not Jesus was crucified. God loves Jesus so much that he turned Judas, he looked like Jesus. And so the Jews was crucified because he betrayed Jesus. And Jesus was lifted to heaven in his body, according to the Islamic tradition. And this is why Judas on the cross would say, why have thou forsaken me? If he was, according to our, and this is
I see.
You know, if he was really the Son of God, he knew that he was the Son of God, and why would he tell his father, why have you forsaken me?
What about the second coming? Christians feel that Jesus will come again.
We believe at the end of the world, the Messiah will come, and he will be the last. He will come at the end and deliver the world. So it's the same thing. History of creation is a little bit different. You believe that Satan, you call it Lucifer, is a fallen angel. In Islamic doctrine, angels have no freedom of choice. They are the civil servants of God. In other words, if God instructs Gabriel to go and tell Mary she's going to be pregnant with Jesus, he can go to Sarah and tell her that. They cannot rebel against God. Only humans are given the freedom of choice with God called trust. Animals don't have everything. I mean, the trees, they blossom in the spring, they shed their leaves in the fall. They don't have the choice. The sun doesn't have the choice to rise from the west. Only man has the free will of choice. So we believe that Lucifer or Satan was not an angel, but he was a jinn. And in Islam, we have the angels, the jinn, and the humans. The angels are made out of light, the jinns are made out of fire, and the humans are made out of clay from the earth. When God created Adam, he brought it to the angels, and he taught him all the names, and he told the angel, tell me the names of you. He said, praise to you, O God, we don't know, we didn't teach us. He said, Adam, tell them. He told them that. So he said, you prostrate to Adam. And all the angels prostrated to Adam as a sign of respect, except Lucifer was there. Why didn't you prostrate? He said, I disobeyed you. He said, I did not prostrate to him because I'm better than he is. I'm out of fire. He's out of clay. And he said, then you are damned. I kick you out of paradise. And so now the struggle between evil and good is not between God and Satan. Satan is created. God is the creator.
Yes.
It is between Satan and men. Because Satan was to tempt man to show God that this person you want me to kneel to does not deserve it.
I see. Okay, so we're fighting with Satan, and
the fight is between us and Satan, not between God and Satan.
And hopefully, the divine spark within us will overcome the evil.
The divine is within us. Depends on our heart.
And this is a theme, of course, that you see in the Buddhist religion too, and the Hindu religions, the idea that there is a divinity in every person.
There is a divinity.
And we bow to each other, we recognize that divinity within.
You are so right on that.
Now, one of the aspects of Islam that's very well known in America is it's something called Sharia law.
Yes.
What is the role of Sharia law in Islam?
Sharia, Sharia is constitution, it's not law. Sharia is a constitution. This is the law as revealed by God. Our interpretation of Sharia, remember that God is absolute, infinite, and we try to interpret the word of God with our limited minds. I remind you, I went to school in Louisiana until 1960. There was segregation in the name of religion, in the name of religious belief and what have you. So when you you can misinterpret the quotation, the Sharia, which is the constitution, and you come out with what we call fiqh. Fiqh is jurisprudence. Now, some people interpret jurisprudence differently, and that's where we got the confusion.
Does Sharia law have specific rules like you can't drink alcohol, or you have to dress a certain way?
No. Sharia is like the Ten Commandments.
I see. It's very general.
Sharia is very general. And the problem we're facing in every religion is the following. Is everything allowed unless specifically forbidden by God? Or is everything forbidden unless specifically allowed by God?
I see, yeah.
So now we have the Salafi that say everything is forbidden unless allowed by God. So
we've talked about in the show,
Marshawn,
the Wahhabis, these are the strict guys who basically run Saudi Arabia, right?
They think that in order, you have to go back to the 604 and leave the way it is. I'll tell you a story. I was given a sermon. I give the Friday sermon every time. I give a sermon during the end of Ramadan, and this guy came from, he was not American, he was coming here as a cousin of somebody else. And at the end of the sermon, I come and shake hands with the ladies and the men and say congratulations. This guy said, oh, wow, the Prophet never shook the hand of a woman. I said, what are you with him? Well, that's what we are told. I said, okay, you don't have a beard, you have this and that. I said, okay, wait a minute. Give me the key to your car, give me your cell phone, go and ride a camel. But the Prophet rode a camel at the time. So these people, they only freeze time, and it's fossilized in their thinking. I respect their point of view, as long as they don't say that I am an outsider because I think differently. The problem with every religion, with every creed, with every party, with every philosophy, is that those who know little are sure of themselves, and those who know a lot, they know how much they lack.
They know what they don't know.
They know how much they lack, and this is the problem.
Wisdom is the beginning of.
Whereas, as a Muslim, I disagree with the Salafi, and I say, you have your point of view. The Salafi will not disagree when they think of me as the enemy.
Yes, yes.
And he's sure of himself, I don't have the certitude that he has. And it applies to the settlers, to the neocons, to the Christian right. Everybody
will see no ambiguity.
We think they are right, and this is the truth and the only truth.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. We're talking to Dr. Karim Adib and about the nature of Islam, how it compares to Christianity. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a ring at 203-336-9756. You can join our conversation at WPKN's In Context by calling 203-336-9756, and you can speak to Dr. Adib about Islam, any questions you may have about its role in the United States, in the world, its relationship to Christianity. To expand on the theme that you just raised, this explains why when I look at the newsreels and I see Muslims in, say, Lebanon, or they're vacationing on the coast of Turkey, and then I look at Muslims who were in Saudi Arabia, and the women are dressed from head to toe, and you know, you can't get a beer, and I'm saying, is this the same religion? Are the people in Lebanon less Muslim than the people in Saudi Arabia?
Well, let me give you an example. Ireland. They were Protestant and Catholic, both Christian. They were killing each other.
Right.
So, religion has never preached fragmentation of society. Religion brings people together. It's the people that trap their special interest in religion.
But one of the Crusaders is more Muslim than another, that because they...
Well, some of them think one is less Muslim than the other. That's their point of view. I respect it, but I disagree with it.
I see.
I think, you know, and I don't know if you know French. It's a l'habit ne fait pas le moine. The dress does not make up the monk. In fact, I was in a service one day, and there were a few imams that we were talking about, and I said, you should do this, you should do that, you should do this, you should do that. And this guy, apparently, he's a Salafi by education, by thing, whatever. He said, you can give your opinion, you don't have a beard, because the Prophet grew a beard.
He said that?
Yeah. He said, you cannot.
And the Prophet does not have a beard.
He said, you cannot give it, you don't have a beard. And I said, you know, I think with my brain, not with my beard.
Yes.
But it's people have different views.
I think in Christianity you get fundamentalists who are sometimes pretty extreme. They think that the Pope is an antichrist.
Oh, gosh. I remember
Marchand, yeah.
I remember many, many years ago I was at Fort Leonard Wood, and a friend of mine, he's a good kid, but he comes up to me and he wakes me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and he goes, hey, so your family's Catholic, right? I said, yeah. He goes, you know the Pope's the Antichrist. I'm like, dude, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay, let me go back to bed. He goes, no. He goes, the Pope's the Antichrist. I think you should know. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to have to ask, what makes you think that? He goes, you know, my preacher said he's an upside-down cross in the back of his chair. And I went, really? It's 3 a.m. I'm going back to bed. But he was very certain of himself. I don't know what he hoped to achieve by telling me that. But it was, you know, think my way and this is the only way sort of a thing. But it really floored me.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I went to school in Louisiana in the 60s for my bachelor's, and then they had Campus Crusade for Christ. Those young ladies and gentlemen, they were sure of themselves, and they thought I was the only Muslim on campus.
Oh, wow.
Everybody was trying to convince me that we love you, you're going to hell, yes. We're going to save you, and do this, and
we love you, but you're going to hell.
You know. And before I left, after 4 years before I left, I said, I want to have a meeting with you guys, and I want your preachers to come in. And I stood and I said, listen, for the sake of argument, I'm going to concede to you that your religion is better than mine. And they all laughed. You know, I said, don't you think my faith is stronger than yours? They said, how come? As I'm still a Muslim, although I'm going to hell, that means my faith is very strong.
That's and a good argument.
Neither them nor their Christian pastors could answer that. I'll tell you another argument. I was arguing with a atheist one day about the existence of God, what have you. So I told him I had to go to New Jersey, and I said, you know, there was a traffic jam on Washington Bridge, and I couldn't take, I'm afraid of the tunnel. So I stood by the Hudson River, and I was waiting. I came on purpose 1 hour late. So I was waiting and waiting, and suddenly some wood came out of the water. More wood came out of the water, nails came out of the water, then the nails were into the wood, and suddenly there was a boat. The boat had no captain, the boat had no engine, it came towards me, I hopped on it. I didn't tell anyone, it brought me back here. I said, are you insulting my intelligence? I said, if you believe that the boat needs somebody to make it, how about the whole universe?
That is a really good one.
But now, that is really good. You're an engineer.
Yes.
But one thing that people of faith share, whether you're a Christian or Islam, a Muslim or a Hindu or Buddhist, whatever, is that there is something other than science, that there's an unseen world, which is as real as the seen world. Yeah. And I mean, that's what separates people of faith from the, so to say, the secularists. And we have more in common with each other.
So I will say one thing. We believe in that there is two types of knowledge. The knowledge through reason, علم العقل, which is reasoning, and the knowledge transferred to us through revelation. And God did not send revelation to justify what the mind already knows. He sent revelation to clarify what the mind is doubtful about.
Yes.
There is a third in Islam, we believe we are three-dimensional. We get our knowledge through the senses. I hear, I smell, I see, this is white, this is solid. And then I process it through my intellect. So you have the material sciences. You have medicine, engineering. Then you have the intellectual sciences. I can dream. I can think. I can, as an engineer, I can see your home before I build it. You know, I could project something in the future. Now this makes me a shallow person. It's two dimensions. The third dimension is spirituality. And like they discovered that the brain is not only a bunch of cells, it has neurons and all kind of areas for storage, I am positive they will discover that the heart is not only a pump, it's the reception of spirituality. That's why you say, she broke my heart, or I felt for him, or I like this dog more than the other, or something like that. So
it's a reality. That aspect of our lives is a reality.
Well, reality is not what we see. I'll tell you an example. I see this wall not because it's there, because there is light on it.
Yes.
If it's completely dark, I will bust my head into it and have a bump on my head. So we need the light of spirituality to see things that otherwise you don't see. That's why you have sight and you have clairvoyance. It's very important to understand there is a third dimension.
And one aspect of that's shared by Jews and Christians and Muslims is the historic time. In our time that we can measure, God reaches down and touches us directly, right?
God speaks to everyone. We have to listen. We have to understand. You see, knowing does not mean understanding. See this light, I know it's white. If I understand, it's made of seven monochromatic colors, if you remember your physics.
Yes.
So,
barely.
There's a difference between understanding. I see the sun moving in the sky. If I understand it, it's me who is moving, not the sun, it's the earth. I ride the train to go to the UN every second Friday of the month. I see the trees passing by me, everything. I'm not stationary, I'm passing by them. So understanding is another level of knowledge, of knowing. It's comprehension, understanding, whatever.
Do we have a caller, Marshawn?
We actually do. This is Ernst from New Haven. Go ahead, Ernst. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Ernst.
Good afternoon, folks. Whenever I hear discussions of this nature, I'm always interested to know if the people speaking have ever taken an afternoon to sit down and ponder why they think they believe the religious myths that they do, and what gives them the confidence to espouse their beliefs as though it is the right and only belief.
Well, thank you, Ernst. That's a really good question.
Number one, I'm not saying that this is the only belief. I'm not saying I'm the only one going to heaven. I'm not saying I'm sure I'm going to heaven. There is something called faith, and there is something called belief beyond reason. Our reason is limited. I mean, if I don't see with my eyes the infrared and the ultraviolet, if I don't hear with my ears the ultrasonic, how do you want me to perceive the divinity of God? And to me, as an engineer, as a rational person, I believe in cause and effect. I believe that everything has a reason to exist and it has a purpose in life. I am Muslim because I feel at ease. I feel at ease with my Islam. It doesn't mean that the atheist is wrong or the Christian is wrong. And let's take this wrong and right out of our lexicon. Let's say it is convenient for me. And I will disagree with you, but I will respect your point of view. And I will take it into consideration.
Ernst, can I ask you a question?
Wait, no, you see, that it doesn't matter what religion we're talking about. I'm just curious if you've ever sat down for an afternoon and pondered why you happen to believe.
Can I answer that question, Ernst?
What you believe, sure.
Yeah, for me, you do try to get to that faith point through logic, but you can't really get there. So I think sometimes it's events in your lives. And for me, it was in being in the hospital when I held my son, my firstborn son, and I looked into his eyes, and I knew that there was something going on. It was that what I felt then and what I feel now was coming from someplace else. It was not a rational response. It was nothing that my professors at Princeton could explain. All right, it was coming from someplace else. Now, for me, that was the experience that did it. Now, do that mean that takes from there? Do I go and believing in the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Well, maybe if I was brought up in if I was brought up in a different culture, it'd make me believe in some other way that God reached down to me. So I think it has to do with culture. But the question I wanted to ask you is. Is it a question in your mind of why do people believe a particular myth, if you want to call it, or story about God, or why do they believe that there's something unseen, that there's a world beyond the visible, that the secular world is just a part of the picture? I mean, are those two different questions in your mind, or are they the same question?
No, my basic perspective is that essentially we don't have answers for anything, so we make them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much that is unknown. You know,
right.
Why do you feel a certain way?
Is the unknown, Ernst, does that include the possibility of another world, of another reality?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm just curious if you gentlemen have ever pondered why this one particular one drew you to be so fervent.
Because
there are so many other people in other religions that are just as...
Right.
Fervent about your beliefs.
I will explain that to you. I believe God has a purpose in everything. Now, I was lucky because...
Okay, that doesn't really approach my question.
I'm answering your question. I'm not done. Once I'm done, you can tell me if I answered it or no. I'm a Muslim. You are a Christian. He's a Jewish. It's an accident of birth. Let's put it this way. None of us has studied every religion and picked up his own or her own religion. I was lucky that when I was 4 years old, I was put in a Catholic school in Lebanon, where I come from. And I studied catechism for 12 years, half an hour every day. I was able to compare both religions. I read the Bible, the Torah, the Quran. When I read the Quran, I found out some events in it. As a scientist, as an engineer, I realized that in the Bible they said the prophet Charles asked the sun to stop because he wanted to finish his battle, and then Galileo came and said, no, the sun is stationary and the earth is moving. The Quran tells me the sun is moving, and now recently we have decided that the sun is moving. So to me, I see certain scientific things in the Quran which draws me closer to it. People who don't have scientific thinking, and you have to realize that we have seven levels of intelligence. Some people learn through singing, some people learn through painting, some people learn through dancing, some people learn through mathematics, some people learn through they are intra-disciplinary, some people are they work in groups. To me, it's convenient for me, it's my zone of comfort. Am I the best? No. I think if everybody, whatever the religion is, are sincere with the religion and apply it, we don't have a problem.
Thank you so much for that call, Ernst. We really appreciate your questions. And if someone else would like to join the conversation, we'd be delighted to receive your call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. We're talking with Dr. Karim Adib about Islam, about its role in the world, in America, about what people of faith, whether they're Christians or Jews or Muslims, what they share. And I'd just like to remind you that next week, next Monday, Christmas Eve, we'll be focusing on Christianity. We're talking about how the modern tradition of Christmas came into being, and we'll be speaking with some people who are living out their Christian faith, who are representatives of our local charities, the Thomas Merton Center in Bridgeport and the New Haven Soup Kitchen. So tune in next week where we'll talk about Christianity. So the number here is 203-336-9756. And it seems to me that Ernst raised a really good question, which is that, you know, why do people of faith have whatever faith they have? And when you ask that question, it shows what we have in common, is that maybe we're led through whatever our family traditions, whatever, to reach God in a different way. But we both share the apprehension that God is there.
I Let me follow one thing up. When I said, you know, that I respect everybody, I've been very active in the Interfaith Council of Southwest Connecticut.
Yes.
And recently I was elected president. This is the first time a Muslim was elected president of an Interfaith Council.
Can you talk about the activities of
just
the council?
Just a minute. Yeah. Anywhere in the United States. And I was elected by rabbis and by priests and by preachers. I was the only Muslim. Well, our interfaith, it's where we have the dialogue. That's where we have dialogue. We try to understand each other. We had a vigil yesterday for the victims of Sandy Hook. We're going to have a day next year sometimes celebrating Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is very
so this will be attended by Muslims as well as Christians
and Jews, and we're open. We have Sikh, we have Buddhist, we have Hindus. It is an interfaith. It's not a council of synagogue and churches. No, it's very, very
inclusive. Can members of the public participate?
Definitely. We would love for you to participate. As a president, I invite you to participate.
Before I forget, then, what's the best way for people to contact these?
Call me. I'm the president, and I'll take care of that.
What number? Can we give out a number, a telephone number, or a website, or an email?
Yes, I will give you. A number and an email.
And this is the Interfaith Council.
Interfaith Council of Southwestern Connecticut. And I will give you, this is the at the bottom.
Okay.
Email and not the top. The top is mine. Okay. The bottom.
The IFC office. Okay. It's 203-348-2800. That's 203-348-2800. That's the Interfaith Council of Southwestern Connecticut. So whatever your faith happens to be, you're welcome. And there's a
website.
Our website is interfaithcouncil.org. That's interfaithcouncil.org. So go to that website and you can get some information about its activities. Do you have any events coming up in the near future that you might like to announce?
We are going to have a Solidarity Day in Greenwich sometimes in January, and we are planning for it. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to know that I come to your station. Whenever I have any activity, I'll call you.
Okay, very good.
And let you
okay, and we can announce it. January looks like you'll be having. So do you have a speaker typically? And
sometimes we have speakers. Sometimes we have panels. We had my neighbor's faith. It was done in Stanford in joint with in conjunction with the mayor's multicultural committee. Mayor Pavia in Stanford is helping us a lot. Yesterday we had also another event for the vigil for the victims of Sandy Hook school, elementary school, and we do have a lot of activities. I don't have them right now.
But the interfaith is promoted largely through meetings, through talks, through education, and through joint prayer?
Education, joint prayers, interfaith discussions, mostly education, and we have a fund. Somebody left us $1 million fund, a respite fund. Well, helping people. Actually, we, for the last 2-3 years, we have been spending it helping people. For example, you're caring for somebody and you care for them all the time. You need to take a vacation for a week to get off. And so we come and send somebody in your place and you take off. We do a lot of work on that.
Do you find that people have a lot of misunderstandings? Say Muslims have misunderstandings about Christianity or vice versa, that they'll come in with ideas that are way off? What's really
yes,
happening?
Yes, they have a lot of misunderstandings. I'll tell you a story that happened to me immediately after 9/11. I'm an engineer. I needed some work in my backyard. And one of the contractors I know well, he's very good. I said, I want you to come and dig in my backyard to see where is the water coming to my basement. And he came, he was digging all day from 8 till 4, all the time telling me how the Muslims were bad, how they worship a black stone in the desert, that the Quran is made by the devil, and I was just listening to him, I didn't say anything. And when we were done, and I said, how much do I owe you? He said, you don't owe me anything, you give me a lot of work. I said, listen, I give you a lot of work because you're good, not because you pat my back, I pat yours. I said, you don't take from me, I'll never recommend you. He said, okay, $600. I said, you charge my clients $800. I'm going to pay $800. I sent him first. I said, no, I want to pay you right now. I have a home office. I went to my office. He came in. I said, take off your boots. They're full of mud. Mm-hmm. He came in. And so I said, I wrote him a check. And I said, send me a receipt. He said, Dr. Adib, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. He said, how come you insisted on paying me? I said, because my religion teaches me that God will not be happy with me if the sweat on your forehead dries up before I pay you. He said, what is your religion? I said, Islam. You should see his face. I'm so sorry. I said, sorry for what? I said, you didn't insult me. What? I said, I didn't feel insulted. How come? I said, have you studied the Quran? He said, no. Have you read the Quran? I said, no. I said, have you met an Islam? He said, no. I said, you didn't insult me. You exhibited your ignorance.
But we are judged. Our religions are judged by how we behave, right?
Exactly. If you hire somebody, a Latin American, a North Korean, an Eastern European, and have an experience with him that is bad, you tend to generalize.
Yes. And of course, every person is entitled to be judged on his own, but we're being human beings, we tend to create stereotypes.
One of our weaknesses as human beings.
Well, we only have 5 minutes left of airtime on the show, about 5 or 7 minutes. So if you'd like to give us a call before we go off the air to speak with Dr. Deeb, it's 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. It's W.P. Ken's Live Public Affairs call-in show. We've been speaking this hour with Dr. Kareem Adib, who's a professional engineer. He's a PhD in engineering, but in addition to that, he's quite an activist in interfaith religious understanding. He's an imam. He's based in Fairfield County. And if you'd like to learn more about, could I have that card again?
I'll give it to you.
Yeah, would you give it to me or put it away?
No, I'll give it.
Okay, Doc. If we can give him a ring. At the Interfaith Religious Council of Southwestern Connecticut, and just have the phone number here is 203. Thank you, 348-2800. 348-2800. That's the Interfaith Council of Southwestern Connecticut, and you can also check out their website, interfaithcouncil.org. Thanks. Do we have a phone call, Marshawn?
We do, actually. We have a couple. This one's Dave from Milford. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
With WPK. We're
trying to make it short, Dave, because we have one more phone call.
Just
a couple minutes.
I just want to ask a quick question.
Sure.
I'm Christian. You're Muslim. I know people who are Jewish. I don't know too many people in the other faiths, but it seems like the people I know are sort of peaceful, but the most vocal proponents of every religion are more violent, or, the fundamentalists tend to get all the spotlight. What can we do about that to try and tone down the dialogue a little bit?
Would you be more specific, please?
Well, if you see Christians on the air, there's a lot of people who are in favor of using violence to solve problems or wars. The TV preachers are the people I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. And if you see the Muslims in the news, the people who tend to be in the spotlight, the Ayatollah or whatnot, and it seems like in every religion, the people who are in the spotlight tend to be the more warlike ones.
Thank you very much, Dave. That's an excellent question. Well, could you take it off the line then? Thanks.
Actually, when you are violent, you attract the news. When you are peaceful, you don't attract the news. I was offered by a TV station. They said, I'll give you half an hour every week if you discuss a controversial issue. I said, I will not discuss a controversial issue. I will discuss any issue that will bring us together. And the guy said, this does not sell. I said, I'm sorry. So what you see, even after 9/11, there was 820 imams in the United States who condemned 9/11. It was not even reported in the news at all. So I'm not saying that the news don't want to make money. But what I'm seeing right now is that if you want to know more about religion, you have the internet right now. It's at the tip of your finger. You can do your own research. Nobody can shape up your thinking. Nobody can create a movement out of nothing.
That's a very good answer, Kareem, because I think that's what it sells newspapers. It sells, gets audience.
Do your own research and find out for yourself.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dave, for that question. And we have one more caller?
Oh, we did, but they dropped off.
Okay, so we have just a couple more minutes
left. 3 more minutes if they want to call back.
It's 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. We're on every Monday from noon to 1, except the first Monday of the month. It's live public affairs call-in here, a listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM. And we thank you very much for your generosity in keeping us on the air so that we can bring you programming that's not available elsewhere on the radio dial. And next week, as I mentioned, we're going to be focusing on Christianity because it's going to be Christmas Eve, and Gus and I are going to be here in the station. And so we're going to talk about how the origins of Christianity, how did Christianity get so commercialized? Bill McKibben wrote a great book called Who Stole Christmas? And this is a fairly modern phenomena, this craziness about shopping and stuff. And then we're going to have on as our guests representatives of two important local charities are going to talk about examples of how the Christian spirit is supposed to be lived out. So that'll be on Christmas Eve. And you know, we talk about commercialism. That really goes to your previous answer, Dr. Deeb, which is the idea that everything is about money. A controversy on the radio, on the TV, it sells advertising. That brings in profits. And the desire for short-term profit is the driving force behind this country, unfortunately, because as we document on our radio show all the time, big corporations control the American government. Big corporations have one value. That value is to maximize short-term profit. Do we have a caller now?
No, I was just
let me say one thing. I think the biggest mistake was to make corporations like individuals.
Yes.
Because individuals have hearts and corporations have no heart.
That's right.
That's number one. Number two, right now we have no more values. We have cost. Well, profit. I've seen many articles that were supposed to be published, but because the people that advertise in the paper, they said, if you publish this article, we'll withhold our advertisement. And sometimes, it's not what you say in the news, it's what you don't say.
That's right. And this falsehood is pushed on us every day. It's something that people of faith understand. People, whether they belong to a particular religion or not, they understand that there are values that transcend profit, and that's what we really need to focus on, and get leaders who understand that too.
And also, we have changed our vocab, our lexicon, to sanitize things. Look at it. I kill my buddy in war. I call it friendly fire. I kill the person.
Collateral damage.
No, collateral damage is the enemy. It's damage.
Yeah.
And now the slaughter terrain is called theater of operation. It's a theater.
That's right.
Which induces a new entertainment and operations curing from a disease. It's a slaughterhouse.
It's like 1984. The Department of Defense wages war.
Shell shock becomes combat fatigue, becomes battle fatigue, becomes post-traumatic stress disorder.
There we go. There we go. And we have to realize that not everything could be solved militarily. We are a human being. Only animals fight. Human people debate, argue, use reason. That's God gave us this faculty that only us have as humans. We don't use it. You don't like my way, I'm going to wipe you out. And no war has achieved its goal. No war.
I think that's a perfect note to end on, because we're actually out of time right now, but that was fantastic.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
We're discussing
Islam with Dr. Karim Adib, and we'll be back next week at noon. We'll be focusing on Christianity and Christmas Eve, and we hope you'll join us then. So thank you very much, Dr. Adib, for being with us. Thank you, Marshawn, too.
My pleasure.
I'm close to you.
Monday, December 17th, continues Music on Film, a winter film series presented by WPKN in the Bijou Theater with our second feature, Quadrophenia. Frank Rodham's terrifically energetic movie, set to the music from The Who's Quadrophenia, is a tale of the battle between two early 60s youth subcultures, mods and rockers, in the seaside teenage wasteland of Brighton, England. The film isn't so much a cinematic version of The Who's 1979 double record rock opera, as it is a story based on the sequence of songs on the album. Quadrophenia is about that crucial time in teenhood when the lion's share of your sense of identity is tied up in the music you listen to, the clothes you wear, and the